will preside. So please give us a moment to get in and out of the courtroom.
Thank you very much. Council can be seated. And Judge Burns is going to join us. And then for record purposes, I will call the case so it'll be part of the file on this case. All right. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. The next case on the call is State versus Galindo. The Chief Justice is recused. Justice Frydenberg is recused. And sitting with us are Judge Burns and Judge Stratton. And counsel can proceed. Thank you. And for housekeeping, I think the argument is now 15 minutes aside. Any wrinkles to that, or are we good?
Could I reserve 5 minutes, Your Honor?
The clerk will reserve 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Adam Sippel. When Mr. Galindo's sentencing case is assessed and evaluated consistent with the law and consistent with the Constitution, his youth, his confession, his cooperation, and his demonstrated remorse provide a strong case to spare him from execution. A reasonable jurist could find, based on those circumstances, that the record doesn't reflect the type of extreme culpability making him one of the most deserving of execution. That's reflected by the prosecutor's letter on October 31, 2002 to defense counsel for Mr. Galindo, expressing his belief that he was the third most culpable with respect to the bank robbery and maybe didn't deserve the death penalty. And Mr. Galindo's argument for life is the reason the prosecutor filed the aggravating circumstance regarding the Travis Lundell homicide. It's the reason he manufactured the jailhouse testimony to prove that allegation. It's the reason that the sentencing panel relied upon that allegation 3 separate times to justify imposition of the death penalty. And it's the reason why this court cannot find beyond a reasonable doubt that consideration of the Lundell aggravator did not influence the sentencing panel in making their sentencing determination.
May I interrupt, and then maybe you will tell me this is not a good question, but if all of the Lundell material was excluded, where would you find yourself in terms
Justice,
of
that's exactly what I want to talk about today. So the state's argument below, adopted by the district court, is to just ignore all this about the prosecutor, ignore all this about defense counsel, ignore the way the record looks with respect to the Lundell allegation, take it off the table, and find that the sentencing panel, we'd have to find it beyond a reasonable doubt, but find that the sentencing panel would return the same sentence nonetheless. Here's the problems with that argument. And frankly, it's no better than the arguments made by the state the first 2 times this case has been before the court. The most important point I want to make today starts with the fact that the arguments and the claims made by Mr. Galindo, if proven and accepted, would change the sentencing balance 5 different ways. They talk about it in terms of just removing the 1A Lundell aggravator and going on from there. Then they ask you to reference the Sandoval case, which of course violates every principle of individualized sentencing that's ever been written in the law books. That's their argument. But the fact is, it changes 5 ways based upon the claims made by Mr. Galindo. First, the Lundell aggravator would be invalidated. Second, the instruction regarding the exceptional depravity, especially heinous aggravator, renders that invalid. That would be removed from the aggravating side of the scale. So 2 aggravators, not 1, 2 aggravators would be removed. And on top of that, over on the mitigating side of the scale, we would add consideration of youth, which we'll talk about today, I hope, constitutionally required to consider my client's age. We'll add the evidence of demonstrated remorse that defense counsel left in his file. So we add 2 mitigators. And then we add a 3rd mitigator because based upon the supposed lack of remorse, the sentencing panel discounted Mr. Galindo's cooperation, which frankly put his life in jeopardy and should have earned him significant credit. And so a reasonable jurist in this case could easily find, if Mr. Galindo's claims were proven after an evidentiary hearing, that the mitigators approach or exceed the weight of the aggravators.
You said that we would have to find that if the aggravators were taken out and the mitigators you're relying on were added back in, beyond a reasonable doubt that they wouldn't affect the determination.
That's correct. I'm sorry.
The district court relied on a different standard, correct?
That's true. The district court standard, frankly, is unclear. First, it refers to the Sandoval case, which is inappropriate. Second, it talks about whether it would be futile to remand it for resentencing. It also explicitly reweighs the aggravators and mitigators.
Well, assume that what the district court did was apply sort of the second prong of Strickland as it relates to ineffective assistance of counsel, or the third prong of Brady as it relates to a Brady violation or prosecutorial misconduct in general. I mean, isn't that standard not the harmless error standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, but a reasonable probability of a different outcome?
Those are the correct standards. Reasonable probability on Brady, undermining confidence in the outcome. I think that standard would be applied to determine whether that aggravator should be invalidated. Once it's invalidated, you apply the higher standard, which is what the state recognizes, which is a very difficult standard to make, harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt. With respect to Lundell, there are, of course, the court knows, myriad allegations, very specifically, very thoroughly, very persuasively pled. Hard to imagine that those wouldn't undermine confidence in the verdict of the Lundell.
I'm not sure I understand exactly where you're going. I mean, we'll take ineffective assistance of counsel first and assume that you've adequately alleged with respect to the Lundell aggravator, assume that you've adequately alleged some deficient performance by counsel. Wouldn't we then have to ask, well, is there prejudice? And isn't the question of prejudice not harmless error beyond reasonable doubt, but a reasonable probability that the outcome would be different?
No, you're absolutely correct, Justice. And I'm just trying to narrow the argument. I'm trying to address what they've raised. Their argument is they don't address that. They go straight to the next step, which is the harmless error standard after the aggravator is invalidated. The problem is we're way ahead of the game here. The process is the allegations create legitimate issues. You grant an evidentiary hearing. You try those issues. You make findings on them. And you would make findings on them using the standard that you have, Justice, articulated.
But you wouldn't grant an evidentiary hearing if, even assuming the deficient performance was adequately alleged, there's no way it would amount to prejudice, correct? I mean, what would be the purpose of the evidentiary hearing if any attempt at proving prejudice would be futile?
I suppose there could be a case where that would be the situation. I can't imagine how that would be the case here. I would note that the state hasn't argued that, in my view. I would note that the district court made no real specific findings on how that could be true, as you see in some other cases. Both the district court and the state have gone straight to the harmless error standard that's applied under Sandoval and Reeves 4. And so if you look at the 1A aggravator, the way that analysis is conducted, the way it was conducted in Sandoval, is that you look to the findings of the sentencing panel. You look to the sentencing panel's order. And when you do that, in this case, you can't find anything that supports a finding beyond a reasonable doubt that they would have reached the same decision for a number of reasons. First, they find that each of the aggravators is significant and substantial. And I know this court relied upon that finding in Sandoval, but it's different here. Here, the Lundell aggravator obviously is potentially a thumb on the death side of the scale. Very significant aggravator. The idea that Mr. Galindo's alleged involvement in a precedent homicide didn't drive the sentence in this case is hard to fathom. sentencing panel doesn't say otherwise. And they do say that with respect to the 1D aggravator with respect to the especially heinous instruction. So with respect to that issue, they did find that even if they didn't consider that aggravator, they would return the same sentence. So it's like a legislature. They knew how to do it. They demonstrated their ability to do it. They declined to do it with respect to the 1A aggravator.
Were there potential questions of constitutionality with respect to 1D that might have caused them to speak particularly about that in a way that they wouldn't with others? I mean, is that fair?
Well, they were aware of the concerns on the 1D aggravator, Justice. You're correct. And so they did have reason to do that. They didn't know all the circumstances surrounding the Lundell aggravator. But nonetheless, that just leaves the court in a position where it has to guess and speculate as to what it would do. Just like in Reeves 3, when the issue of intoxication was not considered or perhaps not raised, and the court found that there's no way to determine what the sentencing panel would have done if they would have considered intoxication, no way to determine what their sentencing decision would have been. I want to just quickly, even though I'm in my time, two real huge issues that I think are just plainly meritorious in our favor is the issue of failing to introduce the evidence of remorse. That's defense counsel's primary duty, is to introduce mitigating evidence. That mitigating evidence is without doubt, it's not of any dubious character. It's in sworn deposition testimony. It comes from a law enforcement captain as well. You know, you can hold it, mark it as an exhibit, and introduce it. Instead, it was left in defense counsel's file. That is a constitutional violation. It affects the sentencing analysis, and it has to be addressed. Secondly, youth. When I saw that in the record, and I started talking about it, I kept waiting for the state to say something about why I'm wrong. I kept waiting for the district court to say why I'm wrong, that somehow it was okay for defense counsel not to introduce more persuasive evidence about the age of Mr. Galindo, and why it's okay for the sentencing panel to say that we're explicitly refusing to consider age as a mitigator. And I haven't heard it. The state hasn't addressed it in a brief. The district court didn't address it in its order. To me, that is a plain constitutional error that affects the sentencing analysis.
Is there case law from this court that age relates to not young offenders but old offenders? And how does that impact the...
There is authority. It's State versus Lauder. Lauder cites a case that was decided before the Supreme Court cases, the U.S. Supreme Court cases that recognize age as a mitigating circumstance. So it just needs to be readdressed. The cases cited in the brief make it super clear that age is a mitigating circumstance. May I reserve the rest of my time?
Please.
Thank you.
Good morning again.
Good morning.
James D. Smith, Senior Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee of the state of Nebraska. First thing I want to say is the law is clear that post-conviction relief is a very narrow category of relief, available only to remedy prejudicial constitutional violations that render a judgment void or voidable. Couple other things I want to mention. Galindo's reply brief relies upon misstating the holdings of both the United States Supreme Court in Clemens and this court in State v. Reeves. In Clemens, the U.S. Supreme Court held that harmless error can be applied by state courts in capital sentencing, including harmless error and reweighting of aggravating and mitigating circumstances, and harmless error in relying upon an erroneous aggravating circumstance. Galindo's reply brief cites Clemens for the opposite proposition.
In the state's view, do we even get to harmless error, or is this resolved on the prejudice element of Strickland and Brady?
Ineffective assistance of counsel would be resolved on the Strickland prejudice standard. And I know I cited in my brief the Supreme Court in a capital case in Strickland, specifically holding that the there is no possibility the claimed additional or omitted mitigating circumstance would have changed the conclusion that the aggravating circumstances outweighed the mitigating circumstances. So Strickland itself goes to the prejudice isn't there.
So if we're analyzing this under Strickland and we assume that we have deficient performance with related to, say, the Lundell aggravator and the other mitigators counsel mentions, remorse and youth, is what we're looking at, if those mitigators are added in and the Lundell aggravator is taken out, is there a reasonable probability of a different result? Is that the Strickland analysis?
That would be the Strickland analysis that the claimed omit, and then it comes down to the claimed additional or omitted mitigating evidence would have changed the conclusion.
But that's not harmless error, right? That's a different...
That's Strickland's constitutional prejudice analysis. There is an important point to make in your assumption, though. As far as the age of the defendant, the district court at the time of its sentencing specifically rejected the age of the defendant at the time of the crime. That's on page 8 of the district court's sentencing order. The district court specifically rejected in its sentencing order any concept that this remorse idea would somehow spare him on mitigation, because on page 7 of the district court sentencing order, the district court specifically said, following his arrest, the defendant planned an escape from jail without any participation by Jose Sandoval, which escape would have involved violence in, if necessary. That would, the rejection of mitigation on those two things I've said would reject the idea that this age of the defendant and maybe some remorse is somehow going to be sufficient to overweigh the aggravating circumstances that were found, if even if you take the Lundell out.
I beg your pardon, the material left. That you just quoted, is that like a finding of fact or is that a narrative?
The material I'm quoting is the court bases that finding on the following. It's a finding.
It's a finding. It's not a pigeonhole of a specific aggravator, much less
a
mitigator.
No, it's a specific finding by the district court at the pages I cited in the sentencing order. I would also point out that the idea that the Lundell aggravator just disappears, you need to look at the district court, which noted that the fact Galindo led law enforcement to Lundell's body, the sixth murder victim, shows no prejudice anyhow for aggravator 1A. That's at page 220 to 221 of the district court's post-conviction order. So the district court is going in the alternative that even if we take the Lundell aggravator out, we still have no constitutional prejudicial error. But the district court doesn't concede that the Lundell aggravator disappears when we have the fact that the evidence shows Glendo, from the trial record, led the investigators to Lundell's body, which then has the district court saying the rest of this by a bunch of these jail informants and everything is just cumulative evidence. So I don't think, at least the way the district court entered its order, that it's necessarily that the Lundell aggravator is out, but even if it is out, the district court still concluded that it would be basically futile to have a post-conviction hearing when there are four other significant and substantial aggravators against one non-statutory mitigator, and per Strickland v. Washington, no reasonable possibility that the claimed additional or omitted mitigating evidence would have changed the conclusion that the aggravating circumstances outweighed the mitigating circumstances. In short, if you go in and murder five innocent people saying that, gee, I shouldn't get the death sentence because I really didn't kill the sixth, that doesn't really indicate a prejudicial error in the sentencing that would justify having a futile evidentiary hearing just for the purpose of saying, was the sentencing order incorrect in sentencing to death?
Is this comment or argument that you've just made essentially that which the appellant seeks has already been done? That in the sentencing order, if Lundell's out and youth and remorse are in?
In the sentencing order, to me, those findings by the district court would reflect having an evidentiary hearing on age doesn't make any sense when the sentencing order rejected
has encompassed those things the appellant seeks.
Yes. He already got the benefit of that when he got sentenced and the district court rejected it.
Thank you.
So why have another evidentiary hearing when the record affirmatively rejects the concept that those, what I would call non-statutory mitigators, are going to override what we have as five or four statutory aggravating circumstances.
This is perhaps ignorance. Is not Lundell a previous crime if it were established to the right degree of burden?
Well, Lundell would fit under... Is it
a statutory aggravator?
It would fit under as a statutory aggravator under 1A.
Okay.
Defendant has a substantial prior history.
So it could impact an aggravator under 1A as found by the sentencing order.
That's
is that correct?
But not the others.
Thank you.
Do we need to look again at how we have defined age as a mitigator? I understood that to be a suggestion made during your opponent's argument.
Not in the context of retroactivity, where the defendant is trying to say that, gee, if age somehow later came into the constitutional analysis by some subsequent U.S. Supreme Court decision, which has never said that's retroactive, the answer to that would be no. There's no, you're looking at prejudicial constitutional error as of the time the defendant was sentenced.
What did the sentencing panel say about age?
I can find it. I'm getting old enough I can't read without my glasses anymore. Sentencing panel says, as far as the mitigating factor, the finding, sub D on page 8 of the sentencing order, the age of the defendant at the time of the crime. Defendant was 21 years of age at the time the murders were committed. Cite State v. Lauder that the Supreme Court interpreted the language of the statute, not the Constitution, interpreted this language to refer to a person of advanced years where senility may be involved. Defendant is not such a person. Panel finds there is no evidence to support the existence of this mitigating circumstance. Concludes it does not apply. So the factor of age was addressed, was considered by the sentencing panel, and was specifically found that it did not apply as a mitigating factor. The sentencing panel does acknowledge he's 21 years old, does point out that the defendant presented psychiatric testimony about the defendant having some psychiatric issues and everything else. The sentencing panel pointed out that the state also contradicted that, and the sentencing panel specifically rejected the defense presenting this evidence of the defendant's mental capacity, mental impairment, and all of that. And in the context of the defendant being 21 years old, it also rejected age. Trying to come in and show a prejudicial constitutional violation, it's not statutory, it's constitutional violation, where you're trying to apply something retroactively to what was not constitutional error at the time, is simply not the way it works. And the ultimate issue I would submit to this court is, can this court, like the district court, conclude upon review of the trial record, Galindo's amended post-conviction motion, that the sentencing panel would have imposed 5 sentences of death, even in the absence of consideration of aggravator 1A, the Lundell murder, and the claim mitigating evidence that they're now claiming. And I would submit it's a de novo standard of review. On de novo review, like the district court, there was no prejudicial constitutional violation in Galindo's death sentences, and thus the district court should be affirmed. And what the district court, I rely upon what the district court entered for an order and signed. It's fairly extensive, has good findings, conclusions, citations to the law, and frankly, the way I submitted my brief is the district court on de novo review, review that order. It's not, there's no error.
Mr. Galindo argues that the allegation that there was a conflict of interest on the part of the prosecutor is structural error that wouldn't be subject to any harmless error, prejudicial type review. What's your response to that?
He doesn't have any precedent to support that. The structural error comes in the context like chronic on ineffective assistance of counsel, saying that it's somehow a structural error overrides the fact that you're supposed to on there's just no precedent that Brady errors somehow become structural errors when this court itself has said when you apply Brady you still have to satisfy the prejudice.
But under chronic, that if I'm perhaps wrong, would say prejudice is presumed.
Prejudice is presumed in the context of a constitutional claim of ineffective assistance counsel.
Right.
It's not a
right.
Brady error.
Okay. A pigeonhole, yeah. Perhaps yeah. A small pigeonhole.
I'm sorry?
A small pigeonhole where prejudice is presumed.
It's a very small one. I know right. I argued prejudicially years ago. Or
maybe I was there.
I argued presumptive error, in which I remember Justice Connolly says the state never gets up and says that to us, and I did that once, but this isn't the case. Okay. Are there any further questions I might be able to help with?
Questions?
Yeah, I would say my brief was short. I thought it was appropriate to be short because I wanted to tell the court, look at the district court's order. It's not de novo review of my brief. It's de novo review of the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time does Mr. Sipple have, please?
2 minutes and 53 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you. May I proceed?
Please.
What Clemens and Reeves say and how they've been characterized in my brief is that Clemens allows harmless error review, but it doesn't allow independent reweighing by this court. It doesn't allow this court to independently assess the facts of record and the circumstances and kind of act as a secondary sentencing body unless given legislative authorization to do so. And this court concluded in Reeves 4 that legislative authority is absent, such that this court cannot get into any of those circumstances that Mr. Smith has suggested with respect to maybe trying to escape from the jail or things like that. It is limited to looking at the sentencing panel's order and deciding whether from that order they would find the same thing. That leads me to the next point for Justice Pappick and Justice Miller-Lerman. I want to be real clear about what the district court did and what it didn't do. Its harmless error analysis, whether it's under the Brady and Strickland standards or whether it's under the Clemens and Sandoval standards, either way, it's limited to removal of the Lundell aggravator. It never addresses adding consideration of youth. It never addresses adding consideration of the evidence of remorse. It never addresses what the sentencing panel would do if they found there was demonstrated remorse. Would they give him full credit for cooperation? And so there are three mitigators on the balance, left off the balance, whatever, part of the mitigating side of the balance, that the district court has never addressed. Likewise.
But we review it de novo, right? So whether the district court reviewed it or not, it's up to this court to review it.
Sure. You could review it de novo, Justice, and conceivably you could find beyond a reasonable doubt that that they would have returned the same verdict even if they hadn't considered the explosive Lundell homicide, even if they hadn't considered the especially heinous and exceptional depravity aggravator, and even if they had considered his youth, and even if they had considered his remorse, and even if, because they considered his remorse, they're going to give him full credit for his life-endangering cooperation. Yes, you could review it de novo, and you could make that finding. I would ask you not to. That yields, that ends my time. I appreciate it. I would ask this court to reverse this case for evidentiary hearings, which we haven't discussed. There's a whole bunch of cases that say that under these circumstances, we get an evidentiary hearing. That's my request. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for today's session. We're adjourned. You're all excused. Thank you.